Okay. Good morning, or depending on where you are, good afternoon, possibly even good evening. At the close of last week's session, Rabbi Kalman and I engaged in a bit of an addendum, a bit of an extension to our prior discussion about messianic calculations. And it's possible, even likely, that many people signed off before they even realized that the discussion was continuing. In addition to that, Rabbi Grodner, actually in correspondence, raised a question about one of the things that I asserted. And in response to him, I discovered some additional information. So the bottom line is that what I propose to spend the time on now is a bit more of an extensive and a bit more of an intensive examination, excuse me, of the entire question of messianic calculations. So if you'll bear with me and bear in mind that all of the sources, including all of the abstruse calculations, can be accessed. If you have a pencil and paper handy and you want to keep track or keep score as we go along, that's fine. But otherwise, you can reconstruct it if you wish at any subsequent point in time. So let me start just by making an observation, not even an observation of my own, but one that I'll share to you courtesy of this website. Without going any further than saying that it's somewhat ironic to have a discussion called "Can I Calculate the Date of Moshiach's Arrival?" on a website that's maintained by Chabad, and I'll say no more unless I'm pressed about it in the discussion afterwards. We saw in Maimonides' letter to the Jews of Yemen that he made reference to a prior calculation that had been made by Saadia Gaon and had been proven to be incorrect. And he then went ahead, and despite the fact that he asserted, as the Talmud asserts, that the Messianic age cannot be calculated, he nevertheless went ahead and proposed what he described as a family tradition that incorporated a calculation of his own that, as we were able to figure it out, was intended actually to be fulfilled within a reasonable amount of time after his own death. So what I want to do just off this website is simply to share with you this little piece over here that indicates that Saadia and Maimonides were not the only scholars of repute to have offered messianic calculations. As you see here in this paragraph in front of you, throughout our long exile, right, beginning over here, okay, many of our greatest sages have calculated the date of Mashiach's arrival. And it includes Rabbi Saadia Gaon, it includes Rashi, Maimonides, Nachmanides, Abrabanel, the Ari, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, even the founder of Chabad, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and the Gaon of Vilna, and many others. So if you want to see at least their take on how can it be that if on the one hand, the rabbis tell us that the date of the arrival of the Messiah is incalculable, and they even go so far as to place a curse on those who would attempt to calculate it, how could it be that so many great and respected scholars nevertheless attempted their own calculations? So if you want to read that, the website is there and you can find it yourselves. Just look up, as it says, "Can I calculate the date of Moshiach's arrival?" Google it and you'll get the Chabad website. Okay. So what, as I said, what I propose to do is to go back to where we left off last week. That is the discussion that I had with Rabbi Kelman to reproduce it here in somewhat greater detail, and then to provide some additional illustrations of just how inexact these calculations have been. So remember again, we started off with the Talmudic stricture that basically placed, as I called it a moment ago, a curse on the bones of those who would attempt to calculate the end of time. This was Maimonides' family tradition. It was based on a verse in the book of Numbers. Curiously, a verse that was not recited by God or by Moses, or for that matter, by any of the Israelites. But it happens to be part of what is considered even by the rabbis to have been a Gentile prophecy. That is a prophecy that was spoken by the seer Bilam. And the verse says, Ki lo nachash bi Yaakov lo kesem bi Israel. Israel does not rely either upon magic or upon divination. Rather, what does it depend on? It depends on prophecy. Okay. So it says, Ka'et, as of this time, Ye'amer li Yaakov ul Yisrael, it will be spoken to Jacob and to Israel prophetically, Mapa'al El, what are the deeds of God? Meaning, whereas other nations use forms of magic and divination to try, as it were, to understand the ways of God, Israel has no need of either magic or divination, because if God wants us to know what he has in store for us, he reveals it to one of us prophetically. Okay. Now, Maimonides' family tradition understood the second half of the verse to be an indication of when prophecy will be resumed. Remember that according to rabbinic tradition, prophecy ended, right? Either at the end, either at the with the termination of the first temple, or sometime during the Babylonian exile. Meaning, there were some prophets, the Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, whose prophetic careers began while the first temple was still standing, but continued into the Babylonian exile, okay? But that basically, according to rabbinic doctrine, from the era of the second temple and on, there was no longer any prophecy, okay? And yet, we know from the biblical book of Joel, from the first verse in the third chapter, where one of Joel's earlier prophecies, reflecting into the future, has God saying, Eshpoch ruchi al kol basar, I will somehow pour my spirit, the spirit of prophecy, out somewhat liberally on all flesh, right? And your children, right, will prophesy. So arguably, that maintains that at some future point in time, the time that we are roughly calling the Yemot HaMashiach, the Messianic Age, the spirit of prophecy will resume. So if you can calculate when the spirit of prophecy will be resumed, then arguably, you have a rough estimation of when the Messianic Age will arrive. And according to this calculation, the word ka'et, at this moment in time, was an indication that the spirit of prophecy would resume when as many years elapsed from that day on as had preceded that day So essentially, if we could establish when the prophecy of Bilaam was spoken, right, then we'd know that in what year, right, to the existence of the world did Bilaam prophesy. Then if we doubled that number, okay, the sum of the two numbers would produce the year to the existence of the world in which prophecy would resume. Now, the Torah, as you may recall, because we read the last sections of the book of Bimidbar not that long ago, okay, the Torah kind of compacts a good deal of very early Israelite history into several brief narratives, meaning we know that from the time that the mission of the first spies failed, the Israelites were condemned to spending 40 years in the desert. However, the mission of the prophets, the mission of the spies, was not undertaken immediately after the Exodus. So even though the language that God uses in condemning the Israelites to wander in the wilderness uses 40 years, the 40 years there is more of a typological number. It's a round number representing the biblical ideal of a generation. So basically, what God said was that the Israelites would have to spend a generation in the wilderness, and he explained why, so that those who had supported the mission of the spies and had accepted their calumnies of the land of Israel would die, right, in the wilderness, while the next generation who didn't bear that responsibility would be the ones who would enter the land of Israel. So since the idea was that they would spend the balance of the generation in the wilderness, it was reported as to be 40 years. But there is a question about whether the mission of the spies took place in the second year after the Exodus from Egypt, or whether it took place earlier. So it's not certain whether the prophecy of Bilaam occurred earlier during this 40-year period, or whether it occurred later in the 40-year period. One way or the other, the conventional rabbinic understanding is that it took place shortly before the 40 years in the wilderness were over. Therefore, the rabbis calculated it as having occurred 38 years after the Exodus from Egypt. Therefore, as you see on the slide, if the Exodus occurred in the year 2448 to the creation of the world, AM, remember, stands for Anno Mundi, right? Years to the existence of the world, okay? Then if Bilaam's prophecy was in the 38th year following the Exodus, then the prophecy was spoken in the year 2486. So if the Maimonides family tradition understood Bilaam's prophecy to mean that the spirit of prophecy, which was contemporary with the rest, with the Messianic era, would resume after another 2486 years, then that would place it in the year 4976 to the existence of the world. And if you remember again that the key number to translate years to creation into years to the common era is 240, right? Of course, disregarding the millennial figure, then add 240 to 976, and it comes out that according to the Maimonides family tradition, the spirit of prophecy would resume in the year 1216 of the common era. Okay. There are, however, other sources, other manuscripts, which have a different date. They have the date of 1210 instead of 1216. That's really of minor That's a minor discrepancy, considering the somewhat larger discrepancy that here we are over 800 years later, right? And we still have not seen either the beginning of the Messianic era or, for that matter, the restoration of prophecy. Okay, so this is as far as we got last week. Let me now... Okay. So, in the discussion I had with Rabbi Kelman, we each of us made reference to an ostensible discrepancy of 165 or 164 or 165 years in the chronology of the Second Temple. So that's what I want to elaborate on now. Okay, so let's take a step back. Look at the very left-hand side of the upper part of the screen. We're now in the year 5782 to the existence of the world according to traditional Jewish chronology, okay? It's the equivalent of the year 2022 of the Common Era. So if we want to know how many years before the beginning of the Common Era was the world created according to Jewish tradition, all we have to do is subtract 2022 from 5782, and you see the remainder. So according to Jewish chronology, the world was created 3,760 years before the Common Era. Okay? Now, so if Abraham was born 1,948 years after the world was created, and as I mentioned already last week, we can calculate that exactly because the Torah records how old everyone was when his eldest son was born. So if we take Adam, Shet, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Yared, Lemech, we go through all the 10 generations between Adam and Noah, and then the 10 generations between Noah and Abraham, right? Then we can calculate with exactitude that Abraham was born in the year 1948 to the creation of the world. That would translate into the year 1812 before the Common Era, right? Simply subtracted 1948 from 3760. Okay? So Abraham was born in the year 1812 before the Common Era. Now you remember again from our discussion of last week that when God told Abraham at the covenant, it's called Brit Ben Habitarim, that his descendants would be oppressed and enslaved for 400 years, the conventional rabbinic interpretation is that the 400-year clock, as I've been calling it, started ticking the moment that Abraham had a descendant. And that would be with the birth of Isaac. Now, remember that Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. So if Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born, and the 400-year clock began ticking when Isaac was born, then arguably the Exodus took place 500 years after the birth of Abraham. So if again, if Abraham was born in 1948 to the existence of the world, equivalent of 1812 BCE, then the Exodus taking place 500 years later was in 2448 to the creation of the world, or 1312 before the Common Era. Okay. Now, here is where things begin to get a little more complicated. Remember, they're already complicated because the whole idea that from the birth of Isaac until the Exodus from Egypt, there were 400 years, cannot be supported by exact biblical evidence. Okay? The best that we can do is we know that Isaac was 60 years old when Jacob was born. Jacob was 130 years old when he came down to Egypt, you remember, because Pharaoh did us a favor and asked him, how old are you? Okay. So that's 60 and 130 is 190. Okay. We know that Moses was 80 years old at the time of the Exodus, right? So we can add to the 190, we can add another 80 years, Okay. But that only adds up to 270. So whether in fact from the time that Jacob came down to Egypt until the birth of Moses, there were exactly 130 years, right? There is no way to reconstruct that according to biblical evidence. Okay? So as I said, when I'm saying that that the calculation at this time gets even more complicated, I'm using the adjective more complicated, not to overlook the fact that there is already a complication. Okay, what's the new wrinkle? The new wrinkle comes from the Book of Kings, which tells us that Solomon completed the construction of the temple 480 years after the Exodus. Okay? Vayhi bishmonim shana v'arba meot shana v'tzeit b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim, right? Dat 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 vayiven habayit l'ashem. Now, do a little math, okay? Remember, if the Exodus is in 2448 to the creation of the world, and the temple was built by Solomon 480 years later, okay, then add 480 to 2448, or alternatively, okay, subtract 480 from 1312, okay? If the Exodus was in 1312 before the Common Era, and the temple was built 480 years later, then, I save you the trouble, I did it on the next slide, right? It turns out, again, if you subtract 480 from 1312, then it turns out that the temple would have been built in the year 832 BCE. Okay? If that figure looks odd, strange, or unusual to you, right, you're probably more accustomed to seeing the date or the approximate time in which the temple was built as closer to the year 1000. Okay? Bear in mind that the discrepancy between 832 and 1000 is approximately 165. So you can see now why, when in my discussion I had with Rabbi Kelman last week, why the number 165 was so prominent. But here we go. This is rabbinic chronology. And when I call it in parentheses art scroll, it's because this is what is taken as historical fact by a lot of Jewish sources. Namely, that the first temple was built only in the year 832 BCE. It stood for 410 years. Right, which means that it was destroyed in 422 BCE. The second temple was built 70 years later in the year 352 BCE. And the second temple itself stood for 420 years, hence its destruction in the year 68 of the Common Era, which, as I mentioned last week, is more accurate than 70. But if you take a look again at the rabbinic assumption that the first temple was destroyed in 422 BCE, you'll instantly spot a more recognizable discrepancy. And that is that everybody knows that the first temple was destroyed by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar in what year? 586 BCE. Of course, the discrepancy between 422 and 586 is the same 164 or 165 years. This is what historical chronology looks like, on the other hand. It has the first temple built 996 BCE, destroyed in 586 BCE, rebuilt in 516 BCE, and again, nobody disagrees on the time of its destruction because that happened so relatively recently in chronology that there really is no way to lose track of it. So again, we have a 165-year discrepancy between rabbinic chronology and historical chronology. The question is, where does the discrepancy arise? It appears to arise in the chronology of the Second Temple. Meaning, again, if the temple was really destroyed in 586 BCE and only rebuilt in 516, then as you see highlighted in this slide, it stood not for the 420 years, which is it is assigned by rabbinic chronology, but it actually stood for 584 years. Again, you may remember from last week's discussion that I provided what I called an apologetic explanation for the inaccuracy of rabbinic chronology by explaining that the rabbis really didn't know. They knew exactly how long the Second Temple had stood from the time that the Greeks arrived in the land of Israel, because that ushered in a new chronological era. We call it the Seleucid era, named for one of the successors to Alexander the Great. Okay. And rabbinic literature calls it Minyan Hashtarot. And that chronological era that began in the year 311 BCE, right, was maintained with such diligence that the rabbis considered it to be adequate for the purpose of Jewish religious and legal documents, so that a ketubah could be dated according to the Seleucid era. A sales contract could be dated according to the Seleucid era, okay? And an era that begins in 311 BCE and terminates in 68 of the Common Era, okay? So you know that if you asked anybody, in what year of the Seleucid era was the temple destroyed? Everybody knew that the temple had been destroyed 380 years after the Seleucid era began. So there was no question, as I said again, in the rabbi's mind as to how long the Second Temple had stood once the Greeks came. What they either didn't know or had inadequate information about was how long had the temple stood previously under Persian domination. And the apologetic explanation is that they somehow thought that it had stood for only a generation, remembering again that in rough typological terms, a generation is assumed to consist of 40 years. Okay. Why would that have made, they made that assumption? As I explained, because rabbinic lore says that when Alexander the Great came to the land of Israel, he was greeted by a Jewish official called Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just. Okay. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot identifies a Shimon HaTzadik as having been a member of the Knesset HaGdolah, a member of the Synod that was assembled by Ezra and Nehemiah at the very beginning of the Second Temple period. Therefore, you remember, things being equal to the same thing are supposed to be equal to each other. So if Shimon HaTzadik, who greeted Alexander the Great, was a member of a synod that was convened by Ezra and Nehemiah at the very beginning of the Second Temple period, then how long could, you know, that period of time have been? So they estimated it as a generation, allotted that generation the typological number of 40, added it to the 380 years that they were certain of, and arrived at the conclusion, erroneously, that the Second Temple had stood for only 420 years. Historical chronology relies, however, on other things. It relies, for example, on Babylonian chronology. the Bible isn't the only source of our information about a Babylonian king named Nebuchadnezzar. There are Babylonian sources about the king Nebuchadnezzar. Now, and those sources also provide us with chronological information. So the question is, why would we rely on Babylonian chronological information? The answer is because we happen to know that the Babylonians were very accomplished astronomers and that their chronology was astronomically sound, meaning if, for example, and this is my example, not an actual one, okay? If, for example, in a Babylonian record, it said that Nebuchadnezzar either became the king of Babylonia or that Nebuchadnezzar conquered the land of Israel in the year in which there was an alignment of certain planets, or a year in which a certain comet was visible, okay, then astronomers today can confirm that that planetary alignment or that appearance of a comet happened in the year 586 BCE. They are consistent with astronomical data for the year 586 BCE. And they are totally inconsistent with any astronomical data for the year 422 BCE. That is why there is an inclination, right, mine personally, but of many others, to accept the Babylonian chronological information as accurate and authoritative. So if indeed the Second Temple was built in the year 516 BCE and destroyed in 68 CE, that indeed the period under which it stood under the Persians was not 40 years long, but it was closer to 200 years long. This, of course, can also be supported by the growing amount of information that we have of Persian history. According to the biblical and rabbinic portrayal of Persian history, there could not have been more than three kings during that 40-year period. In fact, the Talmud reports a tradition that says that several of the kings whose names are mentioned in the Bible are really aliases of the same person. So that there were not three separate kings, one named Cyrus, one named Ahasuerus, and one named Dariavesh, but that actually Cyrus, Ahasuerus, and Darius were three different aliases for the same person. That's how they managed to squeeze all of those different Persian kings into only a 40-year window. Whereas we know now from Persian records and other sources that there were considerably more kings than even those three. In fact, there were at least two kings named Darius. There were at least two kings named Ahasuerus. There were kings whose names are not mentioned at all in the Bible. Here just, you see them side by side, okay? So the question is, was the first temple built in 832 or was it built in 996? Was the second temple built in 352, or was it built in 516? And again, remember, all of these discrepancies are the 165 years. Okay, I think my slides may be out of order. No. Okay. Here we go. Here, this far I got with Rabbi Kalman last week. If historical chronology is right, and the Second Temple was built in 516, the First Temple destroyed in 586, and in order to stand for 410 years, it had to have been built in 996 and not in 832, right? And if the Book of Kings stipulates that the construction of the first temple was completed 480 years after the Exodus from Egypt, okay, then according to historical chronology, when would the Exodus have been? Add 480 to 996. I just neglected to do it on a slide, so I'm just doing it right in front of me. Okay. If it happened 480 years earlier, okay, it would be in the year 1476. Okay, now, you may remember from an earlier slide that when we were calculating the Exodus, beginning with the creation of the world, right, 1948 to Abraham, 500 years later to the Exodus, you remember that 2448 to the creation of the world translated to 1312 BCE. So the question is as follows. If the Exodus was in 1312 BCE, then rabbinic chronology seems to be correct. Because according to historical chronology, the Exodus did not happen in 1312 BCE. It would have happened 165 years earlier, namely in 1476 BCE. Now, again, if you look into a history book, okay, not a Jewish history book, just a general history book, or look up Exodus from Egypt in the Encyclopedia Britannica, will it situate the Exodus from Egypt closer to 1476 or closer to 1312? The tendency will be to situate it closer to 1312. So what we really have here is a double bind, and that is the problem in the chronology of the Second Temple, or is the problem in the chronology that preceded the construction of the First Temple? Meaning, were there really 480 years from the Exodus until the construction of the First Temple? Now, there is no way to support that number through biblical evidence. We know that there were 40 years in the wilderness, okay? That was followed by the era of Joshua. We know that Joshua spent 7 years in the conquest of the land of Israel and 7 years in the apportioning of the land of Israel and another 7 years in the settlement of the land of Israel. So add another 20 years. That's 60 years, okay? Then comes the era of the judges, okay? We do not know, right? We do not know necessarily, even if the book of Judges tells us how long a particular judge ruled, just to borrow the term, right? We have no idea whether the judges were consecutive, right? Or whether they overlapped. And even if they were consecutive with no overlap, we don't know that they followed each other immediately. So even if you added up all of the information in the book of Judges of how long each judge ruled, right, it still wouldn't make up the difference. In fact, towards in the middle of the book of Judges is actually a statement on the part of one of the judges, Yiftach, Jephthah, who in a diplomatic correspondence with the king of the Ammonites says, uses a round number, and he says, we've been here for 300 years. Okay? 300 years is not 480. Ah, but you'll tell me that wasn't the end of the era of the judges. The era of the judges was followed by the era of the kings. So King Saul ruled for 2 years. He was followed by David, who ruled for 40 years. And the temple was built by Solomon in the 11th year of his reign. So that gives you the chance to add another 55, 60 years. You can't make up 480 years solely on the basis of biblical evidence. So what I want to suggest is that what we have here is a mistake in which numbers that were not intended to be taken as exact numbers, but were rather understood at the time to be round typological numbers, caused the problem. And here it goes. Okay. This is the beginning of, from the beginning of the first book of Chronicles, where it provides genealogical lists, but not of all of the tribes of Israel. It provides very exact genealogical lists, basically for two families, for the royal family and for the priestly family. Okay? Now, look at the very bottom, the very last verse that's cited here. Okay? It says that a Kohen named Yochanan, right, bore a son named Azariah. And then it adds something very interesting. It tells us that Azariah, hu asher kihen babayit asher bana Shlomo birushalayim, he served as the Kohen, arguably as the Kohen Gadol, in the Temple of Solomon. Okay? Meaning, none of his predecessors is so designated, right? There's no information given about them other than their names. But the book of Chronicles singles out this Azariah to tell us, by the way, he was the first Kohen Gadol in the first Beit HaMikdash. Notice that I highlighted the names of his ancestors. Want to count them? How many generations was Azariah after Pinchas? Pinchas, whom we know from more recent Torah readings, right, as having been the successor to his father, Aharon HaKohen. So how many generations after Pinchas is Azariah? Twelve generations. I have a suggestion. My suggestion is that when the Book of Kings stipulated that Solomon's temple was built 480 years after the Exodus from Egypt, it was not stipulating it as an exact number. It was rather, in its own funny kind of shorthand, was saying, and you know, the first temple was 12 generations after the Exodus. And if you assign to a generation the biblical round number of 40, then another way of saying 12 generations is to say 480 years. So in reality, it's conceivable that the period of time between the Exodus and the building of the first temple was not 480 years. What would be a more accurate figure? A more accurate figure is that if you actually go through and you add up all of the generations, generational information that's supplied in the Bible, and you divide that into the total number of years that we can determine objectively, it turns out that generation is not 40 years. A generation, a more accurate, I'll call it actuarial definition of a biblical generation, is 27 years. And the difference between 12 times 40 and 12 times 27 is 164. So it's possible that the second temple was built in 516. and it stood for 585 years. And the first temple was destroyed in 586, because that's consistent with Babylonian chronology. And therefore, it had to have been built in 996 and not in 812. But if you're troubled, if it was built in 996, wouldn't that push the date of the Exodus back another 165 years and put the Exodus not in 1312, where it is in accordance with Egyptian chronology, but it would put it in 1476, which is difficult to sustain on grounds of Egyptology? My answer would be, well, the Exodus could still have taken place in 1312 BCE. The temple could still have been built in 996 BCE. And if you're troubled by the verse in the book of Kings, which says that there was a 480-year interlude between those two events, my answer is that the 480 is not meant to be taken literally, but it's meant to be taken figuratively. Okay, we went through this last week. This was a reference to, So last week I gave an example of another false messianic calculation based upon events in the life of perhaps the most notorious false messiah, Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi made his first public proclamation of his, I don't know what to call it, messiahship, in the year 1648, which was the year 5408 to the creation of the world. And that was because there was a calculation already in existence that identified the year 5408 with something apocalyptic. And that's based on the Torah verse, Bishnat HaYovel HaZot Tashubu Ishalachuzato, that in this Jubilee year, everything will go back to the way it was before. And the numerical value of the word HaZot, if you take the hay representing the millennia, right, then the numerical value of the word HaZot is 5408. Now, I'm adding something now to that, and that's a curiosity. Shabtai Tzvi, as you may know, was arrested by the Muslim authorities and was thrown into jail, and then he recanted. Okay, he denied that he was the Messiah, whatever it was. And then he made a reappearance, a second coming. And I use the word second coming deliberately because he timed his second appearance to be in agreement with a Christian messianic calculation. And that's based on a verse in the book of Revelation, a New Testamental book, that talks about the number of the beast. The beast, based on the book of Daniel, is understood to be something relating to the eschatological future. Okay. And it says that the number of the beast is 666, right? 666. So Shabtai Tzvi, who had failed in his first messianic appearance in 1648, which was relying upon a Jewish messianic calculation, timed his reappearance for the year 1666, as it were, somehow playing upon a Christian messianic calculation, of which we don't need the exact details here. You can look them up. This is just simply straight out of Google on the number of the beast. Okay. But just to show you how biblical material relating ostensibly to the end of days becomes part of general culture. This, if you can see this is an etching that Rembrandt drew for a book that was published in the middle of the 17th century by a neighbor of his in Amsterdam, by a Jewish rabbi named Manasseh ben Israel. And the statue is of the etching is of a statue that is described in the first chapter of the book of Daniel as something that King Nebuchadnezzar dreamt of. He dreamt of a statue with a head of gold and a torso and arms of silver and loins of bronze feet of iron and clay. And these were supposed to represent four kingdoms. At the end of the fourth kingdom, right, the Messiah would come. The first kingdom is identified in the book of Daniel itself with the Babylonians. That's the kingdom of gold. The follow-up kingdom of silver is identified as the kingdom of Persia. The loins of bronze with Greece, and the legs of iron and clay with Rome. So you can see how this vision in the book of Daniel has become so much a part of Western culture, as said, courtesy of Rembrandt. Here's the text in the book of Daniel. What I want to do is just simply come to the conclusion here and share with you the last slide. This one by from an article on the subject, and again the link is here. I apologize for having lost the full screen. The link to the article is here. Rav Meidan is one of the Rashi Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion in Gush Etzion. And it's a very interesting point that he makes here. It's the one that I've highlighted. He says that anybody who's been attempting to calculate the Messianic era, a future Messianic era, based on information in the book of Daniel, right, can never succeed, by virtue of the fact that Daniel never looked that far into the future. He says, four lines from the bottom, to our humble view, Daniel's vision never went beyond the Greek Empire and what came in its wake. Therefore, any information that you find, any information, the four parts of the statue, the four beasts in Daniel chapter 7, the numbers that we saw last week, 1,200, I'm sorry, the number, yes, the numbers, 1,235 that are in the later chapters of Daniel. None of that information was ever intended to forecast, or if you wish, to prophesy anything beyond the era of the Greeks. He never envisioned the Roman Empire, and certainly not the Islamic conquest. We thus propose to explain all the calculations of the end of history and the redemption in a way that is different from the accepted approach. And if you want to see what he does, you'll just have to follow the link. Okay. Next week, we'll move along into the next of Maimonides' public letters, the one that is called the letter or treatise on the subject of resurrection, Mamar Triyat HaMetim, and we'll see that there was considerable controversy in Maimonides' lifetime, certainly no less controversy than there continues to be today, over just what does the Messianic era mean, what's the relationship between what we call Olam Haba, Yemot HaMashiach, Triyat HaMetim, are these three different names for one and the same era, or are they three different eras? Do they overlap, or are they consecutive? We'll see all of that beginning next week. Let me see what we have here. Okay. 1216 was the Fourth Lateran Council against the Jews. That's just a fascinating coincidence. Okay. Okay. Determine the Jameson in 7 years. I do it myself. I read about it. It was, as I said, based on dividing the total amount of time that we can actually track in the Bible by the total number of generations that we can track during that same time period. And if you divide the one by the other, the answer turns out to be 27, or so it was maintained. Obviously, it's a bit tendentious because, as I said, it certainly comes in very useful since the discrepancy between the two is exactly the 164 that I've been looking for. But it's altogether too tempting to discard it entirely.
Can I ask you a question?
The source sheets are posted. Okay. And there we go.
Can I ask you a question about Tipach Atzman, which you mentioned? Do you think there's a connection between Tipach Atzman and the Midrash about the bones of the Ephraimites who left Mitzrayim early?
I assume that one could make a homiletical connection, but I know of none that's suggested textually.
Thank you.
As I said, it would make a fascinating homily, because remember, the Talmud asked the question about what happened to them, then clearly it considered the possibility that nothing happened to them, that there was no continuation. So indeed, that would be a possibility. On the other hand, however, it would mean that Ezekiel, before he saw bones, would have to see ground up bones, and they would first have to come together to make bones, and that's not part of his vision. So as I said, it would make a good homily, but it's not supported textually.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.